Yes, my name is Alan Haber. I live in Alon Shvut, Gush Etzion. I'm a teacher and a tour guide, as you heard. The teaching part, I teach mainly in programs for American students here in Israel, mainly here in this building on TVA, also a few other places. And I'm also, as we said, a tour guide, and what's relevant for what I want to talk to you about this morning is that, among many other things, I also do birthright tours a few times a year.
Oh, birthright.
Birthright. Okay. I mean, okay, my understanding is that the theme this summer is Kibbutz Galuyot, right? And that you're examining different diaspora communities, different Galuyot, different exilic communities around the world throughout different points in history, from what it looks like from the very interesting schedule. I have to tell you, I looked at that program. I wanted to join the program and come and sit in a lot of these classes. I could have. Unfortunately, my schedule doesn't really allow. But with the eye to the fact that eventually all roads lead back here to Medinat Yisrael. And I understand that today, I think we yesterday also, we're talking about the United States. So I want to, in this talk, analyze the experience of the American Jewish community today, now, in the 21st century. Now, that's that community, the American Jewish community, is a community to which, of course, many of you belong currently. I was born in that community, grew up there, but left over 20 years ago. I'm still very closely connected with that community, both my family that still lives there, my students, and I was in the States a few months ago, etc. But
where was still, home in the States?
Where was home in the States? Okay, I was born in Brooklyn, grew up in New Jersey.
Where
in New Jersey? Most of my childhood, Livingston, New Jersey. Lived for a while in Washington Heights, went to Yeshiva University, got married, was in the Kollel there a little bit, and spent 4 years in Muncie. For making out, yeah? Muncie, yes. Muncie to Alon Shvut.
Wow. Interesting.
Nice. It was actually a pretty straight path, even though it doesn't look like it. So my point in mentioning that is that although I'm very closely connected with the American Jewish community, I do have a certain distance, and I can look at it a little bit from the outside as well. And what I would like to do in the next few minutes is to first sort of analyze objectively the current American Jewish experience from a historical perspective, and I'll explain to you what I mean by that. I want to take a look at what is the situation, under what conditions do Jews live in the United States today, and how does that look in comparison to all those other diaspora communities that existed from the days of the Churban Beit HaMikdash until now. I want to then sort of step back and look at how the American, again, sort of from my quasi-outsider's perspective, hold up a mirror, if you will, and take a look at how American Jews, across the spectrum of American Jews, are reacting to those conditions, how they're responding. And then, after what I think will be some very, very interesting results of all this, I'd like to, at the end, take a look at what maybe this all means from a Torah perspective. So that's what I'm going to try to do in the next... we have an hour, right? Yes, but it's supposed to end at 11:30. Okay, good.
11:30.
Just say that. I won't go over time. Okay, I hope. When Shuli contacted me a few weeks ago to ask me to give the shiur and tell me what the topic is, so there were two things going on at that time. First of all, my personal life, I happened to be running a birthright tour at that time, which I'll get back to in a few minutes. And it also was right around the time when the American Embassy moved over here to Jerusalem, and of course that was the news, and everybody was talking about it. So both of those things were kind of flowing through my head as I began thinking about what we're going to talk about this morning. I'll get back to birthright in a few minutes, but when it comes to the embassy, what struck me at that point, And nothing I'm about to say reflects any political position whatsoever. I'm not taking position for or against President Trump or any other president or any other. I'm just looking at the situation. The fact that right now, American policy of the United States towards Israel and the Middle East in general is being very largely dominated by three Orthodox Jews from our community. I'm talking, of course, about David Friedman, the ambassador, and Jason. And Jared Kushner grew up around the corner from me. I don't know if you're even, I knew him as a small.
His parents have a venture from his bar mitzvah.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, I think I may have even been in his bar mitzvah. My parents probably were. He was a little kid when I got married, but I know his parents quite well.
So three Jews, you said.
So three Orthodox Jews. Jared Kushner, David Jason Friedman, the ambassador, and Jason Greenblatt, who's the president's special envoy to the Middle East. Yeah?
And Rabbi Lookstein, who officiated at their wedding, is a very big friend of mine.
Also true. Okay. That's, again, regardless of policy or anything else, the fact that Jews and openly identified Jews are so close to the center of power is remarkable. In fact, without making any predictions whatsoever, but the idea, you know, when I was a kid growing up in America, one of the things they always tell children in America is anyone can be the president. You could be the president. And, you know, on paper, that's true. Until recently, at least, the idea that a Jew could be president of the United States was not something that I at least took seriously. But at this point, I don't know if it'll ever happen. But it, to me, it seems totally possible. And that says more about America than it does about the Jews. There's already been a black president.
Well, so drivers are very against Jews being.
I'm not saying if it's good or bad. Hold on. Right now, I'm just analyzing.
Yeah.
We're not up to evaluating it. Right. I'm just looking at the situation. I'm not judging anything.
But you identify these three people as Orthodox Jews.
They are.
They might say they are. I mean, I don't know
I'm not judging anyone's as they used to say. I'm not checking anyone's tzitzit. These are people who openly. It's not my business to judge people's actions. These are people who identify as Orthodox Jews or are members of Orthodox synagogues who live in at least until they assume their current positions. At least live in Orthodox communities.
And Jason is my cousin.
Okay, there you go.
All right.
I'm not.
We have your autograph.
My issue is not to evaluate anybody's practices or anything like that, but the point is this. Not only are they Jews, but they're Jews who are very, very open about their Jewish. Okay? And when I look at that, and I'm going to say something that some may challenge, so let me just make the case, and then you can challenge it if you want, but I think this situation has never existed. Nothing like this has ever happened before, and this is completely unique in the annals of Jewish history. Let me explain what I mean. The idea that Jews can rise to very high positions and be very close to those in power has happened before. Okay, there are many names we could mention. I'll just mention one, for example, Don Yitzchak Abravanel, Jewish Torah scholar and financier in the Middle Ages, who was very, very close to the king of Spain. And that's just one of many examples I could pick of a Jew who reached very, very, very high positions, was exceedingly wealthy and exceedingly powerful. But when things like that happened in the past, the Jews who reached those positions always understood, and even if they didn't understand, history showed, that they were there not by right but by privilege, and that they were completely vulnerable to the whims of whatever government was in power. And the story of Abravanel proves exactly that. Because his ultimate fate was to be expelled from Spain in 1492 with the rest of the Jewish community in Spain. He tried valiantly to prevent it using his influence and managed to even delay the expulsion somewhat, shortly, and almost, according to some accounts at least, almost managed to have the decree canceled, but in the end did not, and Jews were expelled. He was offered a personal exemption by the king, King Ferdinand, who allowed him to stay if he wanted to, and he said, no, thank you, and I'm going with my people. So that proves the point, right? And that's just one example of many. So the idea of Jews reaching positions of influence is not unique. But there's a difference. Now, the idea that Jews have equal rights under the law and are not subjects there by caveat or privilege, but by right, on paper has existed in many Western countries for a few hundred years, since what we call the emancipation, okay, which began in the late 18th century, right? The idea that Jews, well, let's first point out, maybe this needs to be stated also, until the 18th century, such a concept was revolutionary. In the time of the Bravanel, the idea that because you're a Jew, you're not a citizen, and you don't have rights, and if you're allowed to be here, and the conditions under which you're allowed to be here is completely up to the government, whatever they choose, either due to the goodness of their heart, or because more likely it's in their interest to do so, and the minute that changes, you're out. That was the norm throughout all of history, until this dramatic change that took place in the 18th century, first with the American Revolution in 1776. So the United States is actually the first place in the world, at least in modern times, where Jews had absolutely equal rights. And then shortly afterwards in France, the French Revolution, 1789, and in the wake of the French Revolution, most other Western European countries, and later, of course, other democracies in North America and other parts of the world. So on paper, Jews have had equal rights for over 200 years. Close to 250 years, I guess you can say, in at least some places. But that's been on paper. And the reality was very different. And in fact, we'll get to him in a few moments, but I put it number two on the sheet. When I was thinking about this talk I was going to do about American Jews in the 21st century, my mind kept going back to a Jew who didn't live in America and didn't live in the 21st century, who died over 100 years ago in Vienna. Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl.
Today is his 114th yahrzeit.
Really?
Yes.
That is something I did not know. Okay? Thank you for that tidbit, especially because I'm guiding later today at Har Herzl. So I have to take that. In fact, they just told me they weren't going to go to Herzl's grave, but maybe we'll change that. This is actually your side. I did not know that, so thank you.
Wait, today is the yahrzeit?
That's 114.
Okay, so right. So why, when talking about American Jews in the 21st century, am I speaking about an Austrian Jew who died 114 years ago and who's most prominently associated with the State of Israel? So we'll get back to Herzl in a few minutes. But Herzl was very much a product of that emancipation, and was very much frustrated by the fact that it didn't seem to be working, and that what existed on paper was very different than the reality. We'll get back to Herzl in a few minutes, but that is the defining characteristic. Herzl's, of course, the founding father of the State of Israel. There's no doubt about that. But he's a very improbable figure to do that, as we'll see in a few minutes. And the defining characteristic of most of his life was a deep, deep frustration and disappointment with the fact that he grew up in a world where he was told that he's absolutely equal and that being a Jew was not a liability at all. And every experience he had showed him the exact opposite. The theory of the emancipation back then was that Jews could become citizens and could be made equal members of society provided they showed themselves worthy of doing so. Which didn't require them to give up their religion or convert to Christianity in theory, but did require them to be Jews who didn't look or act any different than Christians. And even then, when they tried to do exactly that, they found that it wasn't really happening. But my sense is that in the 21st century in the United States, and I say 21st century, this wasn't true even to this extent when I was growing up, but today, my sense is that it really is true. That what Herzl didn't see in late 19th century Europe does exist today in 21st century America. And my sense is that America is different than any other part of the world. I've traveled a bit, not extensively, but I've been to Jewish communities in other Western countries, in England, in Australia, some other places as well. My sense is that the United States today is different, even Canada. Any Canadians in the room? Even Canada, where the life of Jews certainly aren't persecuted, thank God, but it's not the same. Just to give you a few tidbits, the United States today is probably the only place I've been that I can think of where it's very common still for a synagogue not to have a security guard and even to have the door unlocked where you can just walk in. I haven't seen that, except for Israel, I haven't seen that really in other places. Not every place in America either anymore, but there are still many places where you can just walk into a shul, right? Many places where Jews feel secure enough to do that. Contrast that, for example, to a country which is not known for anti-Semitism, Australia, for example, where I was shocked that many years ago, where to walk into Daven Shacharit in Sydney, I had to go through a metal detector, but not just that. The security guard was very, very nervous when he saw a stranger walking in. Who are you? What are you doing here? Came to Daven Shacharit.
But it's changing states.
Also, no, there's no question. There is anti-Semitism in America as well. There's no question about it. But it's true. It's true. There's no question about it. And look, security guards are very common here in Israel too. I'm not denying that. But I still have the sense that America is still different, and that while there is anti-Semitism in America, as there is everywhere, it is still very much a marginal phenomenon in America. Another example you can see for that is the ease and the comfort with which people who do choose to wear kippot feel they can do so.
Changing
what, in a negative direction?
In the wrong direction. My son works downtown Chicago, and he finds it not as comfortable as it used to be to wear his kippot.
Okay, but let's put things in perspective. When I was growing up, even,
I know.
Nobody came out, except for people in very specific businesses, you know.
Chicago more so than New York.
Could be, it depends where. But I know people not only in New York, in LA and other places, in all sorts of professions, if you're perfectly comfortable wearing kippot to work. You have people in the media wearing kippot, either actual people who wear kippot or characters in TV shows and stuff like that who, you know, are portrayed. You know, it's Jews in America today, I think. And again, I return to these people with very, you know, so again, Jews reaching high positions of influence has happened. Jews having rights on paper has happened. Jews having actual equal rights in practice. And again, one doesn't have to say that there's no hatred or opposition to Jews to say that they're absolutely equal. Again, is there racism against blacks in the United States? Of course there is. But you can't say anymore that a black person can't be president. Okay? So, at the very least, Jews are in the same situation. I don't know if there ever will be a Jewish president, and I certainly don't ever know if there should be one. But the idea that there could be one, to me, doesn't seem absurd at all anymore. Even an openly identified Jew, even an observant Jew. And that's never happened before. So, in that sense, I think, the phenomenon that exists today in the United States is unique in Galut. The Jews really are treated, or at least by all appearances at least, Jews really are equal, and so they feel. What's fascinating is that this very unique phenomenon, unprecedented phenomenon in Jewish history, occurs in the same generation as another completely unprecedented phenomenon. And that, of course, is Medinat Yisrael. And that, for sure, is unprecedented. At least since several hundred years before Churban Bayit Sheni, and really, you have to go back to Bayit Rishon to have anything like it, where you have a sovereign, independent Jewish state in the land of Israel, or anywhere in the world for that matter, but especially in the land of Israel. That is completely unprecedented, where Jews have sovereignty, where we're not ruled by anyone. We're ruled by ourselves. And these two phenomena, both of which are unprecedented, a diaspora, where Jews have real equality, and Medinat Yisrael, where Jews have sovereignty, are occurring at the same time. And now let's go a step further and point out that between those two communities today, you have 85% of the Jewish people today. Okay, if you want some numbers, nobody knows exactly, but by most accurate estimates that exist right now, there's about 14.5 million Jews in the world today, which is still less than pre-World War II, by the way, although Baruch Hashem, we're catching up. 14.5 million Jews in the world today. The largest number by far is here in Israel, 6.4 million. That's approximately 44%. Then there's 5.7 million approximately in the United States. Together, that's 12.1 out of 14.5 million Jews. It's about 85%. Leaving only 2.1 million Jews scattered throughout the rest of the world in much, much smaller communities. The third largest Jewish community is France, which has a little less than 500,000. Okay, and then you have about a bit under 400,000 in Canada. Okay, and if you choose to group North America as one community, which one could argue, Australia has a very small, less than 100,000, a few tens of thousands.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. England has just under 200,000, I believe. The entire former Soviet Union, Russia, and all of its former satellites under 300,000, and very small numbers everywhere else. Okay, so think about what that means. That means that essentially, numerically, the only significant diaspora community left is the United States. And if one believes, as I firmly do, that Medinat Yisrael is Reshit Tzmichat Gulatenu, and that the future of the Jewish people is here, and one can see that, I see that, first of all, very clearly in the Nevuot, but also in history, and also in demographics. Every single Jewish community in the world today is shrinking, including the one in the United States, unfortunately. And the community in Eretz Israel is growing, and is growing rapidly, even just via birth rate.
Babies are our business.
The birth rate, the Jewish birth rate in Israel is over 3.1, I think, children per woman, which is astounding. It's the largest anywhere in the Western world. And the in the Jewish world, it's the only place where I think the United States, the average is 1.8 children per woman, which demographically means negative population growth. There are 44% of the Jews in the world live in Israel, but over 60%, maybe close to 70% of the Jewish children in the world live in Israel. And what all that says is that the United States is not only, the American Jewish community is not only the most unique diaspora, the most unique galut ever, but it's also the last. And what does all that mean? What does that mean when we look at a world in which 85% of the Jews, well, maybe you could put it differently, by the standard definition of what galut meant, one can question whether the American Jews are exactly in Galut. They're not in Israel, but certainly it's a very unique and unusual diaspora. And is it even exiled by the current definition, and what does that all mean? So an attempt at a philosophical slash theological slash prophetic interpretation, we'll get to in a few minutes. But before that, I want to go down a little bit to a deeper, a higher resolution, and look at how are American Jews across the board responding to this very unusual situation? Because if you look, when you study, I have a master's degree in Jewish history, by the way, and when you study Jewish history, that's what you have to ask yourself. And at each Jewish history, at least after a certain point, is the history of Galut and diaspora. And in each situation, you have to look at the conditions of their lives, and then you have to look at how they responded to those conditions. So if I look at American Jews today, how are they responding to these conditions? I can identify at least three different responses. Okay, the largest, most common, by far, is assimilation. And here's some more numbers, and then I'll share some experiences also, getting back to birthright. But according to the most recent data, at least one-third of American Jews are not affiliated with any denomination at all, even on paper. Neither are those who declare themselves as Reformed Jews. If they're not in that number, or conservative Jews, that doesn't even automatically mean that they're a member of any synagogue or that they've stepped foot in one at any point in the recent past. But even by declaration, one-third of American Jews declare themselves as, there's a category now, they ask you to define your denomination or whatever it is, and there's a category called just Jewish. That's it. I'm not a Reconstructionist Jew. I'm just Jewish. And we'll get back to what that means. Not even a cultural Jew. I'm just Jewish. And about one-third of American Jews identify themselves that way, and that category is the largest growing category. Fastest growing. Intermarriage among non-Orthodox Jews is up to 70%. Okay, the actual number is around 60%, but when you remove Orthodox Jews from the number, where intermarriage is almost non-existent, when you look at the broader Jewish community, it's up to 70%. And that's nationally. In many locations, it's above 90%. Depends where.
When they talk about intermarriage, are they talking about whether it's a man or a woman?
It's complicated. Even the numbers I quoted to you earlier, by the way, are not exactly halachic Jews. They're what The main demographer who deals with this is Sergio De Pergola or something like that. Something like that, here in the Hebrew University. Who there's a lot of arguments about these issues, but I think he's generally recognized as the world expert on Jewish demography. And he talks about what he calls the core Jewish population. That's the 14.5 million I gave you, which are people born of at least one Jewish parent who strongly identify as Jews. So that's not even the halachic Jewish population. There are less than 14.5 million halachic Jews, although most of the core Jewish population today is still halachically Jewish, although that may be changing. Today, that's still true.
Spanish, Portuguese, so important to us right now.
What do you mean?
Finding the Jews coming back.
That's a whole other conversation, right? That's just one example of Jews from around the
world. Potential is 5 million.
Yeah, for sure. Not only, that's only one example, though.
Right? Yes.
Okay, but that's a whole separate conversation, and maybe it's coming up in some of the other classes. These lost Jewish tribes that have come back, and the Ethiopians that already come back, and B'nai Menashe, and okay, but that's a separate conversation. In any case, here, look, the first verse on the page is an article that's already 5 years old, but just to give you some numbers on one of the more recent surveys, 78%. Jews said that being Jewish is part of their religion. This is 5 years ago. The numbers are probably different today. 22% they are Jews with no religion. But even those who, the 78% who say my religion is Judaism, only 30% of them say that that's very important to them. I'm not talking about what definition of Judaism. You can be a Reformed Jew and say that your Jewishness is and your Judaism and your Jewish religion is very important to you. And I do know Reformed Jews like that. That's 30% of the 78% 5 years ago. 62% say being Jewish is mostly an issue of ancestry and culture. And if you ask me what's the just Jewish category and how is that different than culturally Jewish, more and more often it comes out to ancestry. And I see this on Birthright. Definitely not all, but many of the kids who come on Birthright, their Jewish identity is a minuscule part of their identity. They came on Birthright because they got a free trip. And they're not ridden by pangs of self-hatred or anything like that, like the type of thing that maybe some read into Herzl, and we'll get back to him in a minute. They just, they're American, that's what they are. And the fact that they're Jewish is basically just an interesting little tidbit about them. You know, it's like an ethnic heritage type of thing. My friend is Italian, my other friend is half Asian, I'm Jewish. Maybe they went to Hebrew school and can, even sing a few songs that they remember from there or something like that. In some cases, yes. In many cases, not even that. So you ask them, what does being Jewish to them mean? All they can say is, well, I'm just Jewish. They're not even culturally Jewish so much anymore. These are not the Jews, when I was growing up in the 1970s, my parents' friends, being Jewish, there used to be this thing, kosher-style restaurants. Remember that? Right? The food was treif, total treif, but you felt Jewish. It was like chopped liver and matzo balls. They don't eat chopped liver and matzo balls. Their grandparents maybe ate that stuff. Probably not even. So what is being Jewish? They're just Jewish. And when you ask them what does being Jewish mean, so they're grasping for it. Look at the last paragraph here. Most Jews also said that remembering the Holocaust, 73% 5 years ago, and leading an ethical life were essential to their Jewishness. Only 19% said following Jewish law, without getting into whose definition of Jewish law, was essential to Jewish identity. On my most recent Birthright trip, a few weeks ago, one of the things we do on Birthright, we have this activity called the Jewish Identity Program or something. It's a classic, those who've been involved with informal Jewish education, it's a classic type of thing. You give out these cards with different Jewish values or things that you might define as Jewish values. So everything from observing Jewish law, observing Jewish holidays, marrying a Jew, raising Jewish children, to eating Jewish foods, to even having a sense of humor. I don't know why somebody considers that to be a Jewish value, but that's on there. I didn't know the Jews were known to be particularly funny, but I guess we are.
That's part of the Diaspora Museum, section on Jewish humor, American Jewish humor.
Okay, so right, but that's not saying that Jews are more funny than others. It just says that we have our own type of humor.
Well, look how many of the classic comedians were Jewish because they couldn't get into acting. They find another aspect.
So humor became a Jewish thing because...
The same thing.
But that's also showing, though... That's also showing how things have changed, because today, if you want to be an actor, I think you can.
Yes.
Right?
Correct. And the screenwriters and directors, I did a paper on this, you know, they couldn't be actors in front of the camera, so they took parts behind the camera. So most of the major studios at one point were Jewish owned.
Okay, so that's just going back to what we said before. So that just reinforces my point that 21st century America is different than 20th century America. Right? Things really have changed. So even if there may be, in some cases, maybe a little bit of a correction, moving backwards a little bit. Right? But...
go on any of the campuses.
Okay, so there's... it's a struggle. But
that's the difference between these people who have attitudes towards people who are just Jewish versus people attitudes towards people who are Jewish. I think that's...
what do you mean?
People are very accepting of... the overall American experience is very accepting of people who are just Jewish. It's, you know, they had a Jewish grandparent, but it's just, as you said, you know, it had really plays, you know. But a Jew who identifies, not necessarily religiously, but even Zionism, becoming
so I'm going to get back to that in a second.
It's much more problematic.
I'll get back to that in a second also. But again, undoubtedly, and again, part of this for sure is me looking from the outside, so to speak, but precisely because of that, I can tell you that there are many places where even Jews who strongly identify as Jews, religiously and or culturally, nationally, Zionist, etc., you know, doors are open to them. But still, by far, the largest American response is assimilation. And here... is where, strangely, every time I started looking at this, I just kept going back to Theodor Herzl. So let's go back and just understand how Herzl came to... I know this seems out of place if I'm talking about American Jews, but I think it's relevant. The process that perhaps reached its culmination in 21st century America began 250 years ago in America and also in Europe. Right? The American Revolution again, 1776. And shortly after that in Europe. And Herzl grew up in Europe, to an assimilated Jewish family. His parents were wealthy. He was given a great education. And he thought the world should be open to him. And everywhere he went, he started finding out that was not the case. And what was called then the Jewish problem, or the Jewish question, okay, when 60 or so years later, when Hitler spoke about the final solution to the Jewish problem, he didn't invent the term Jewish problem. That term, Judenfrage, the Jewish question. That was a term that everyone, Jews and non-Jews alike, were talking about throughout the 19th century. The Jewish question, what do we do with these Jews? Or how do we Jews, what do we do with this situation that we're in? So Herzl was obsessed with this. And for much of his life, actually for most of his life, he was a Zionist. He died, unfortunately, at a very young age. He died a broken man at the age of 44. Only for the last 7 years or so of his life was he a Zionist. And until then, even shortly before he wrote the landmark book, Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, and a year later convened the first Zionist Congress, even just a few years before that, he was deeply immersed in the idea that the solution to the Jewish problem is we have to assimilate, and we have to assimilate even more dramatically than we have until now. Take a look at this quote. This is from Herzl's diary in 1895. Okay, the book The Jewish State was published in 1896. He convened the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897. Okay, and when he wrote this, he was already involved in writing what became the first draft of that book. And here he reflects on something that exists that he was thinking just 2 years earlier. So he's telling you in 1895, that's something he was thinking in 1893. About 2 years ago, I wanted to solve the Jewish question, at least in Austria, with the help of the Catholic Church. I wished to gain access to the Pope, not without first assuring myself of the support of the Austrian Church dignitaries, and say to him, right, he's imagining himself having a meeting with the Pope, and say to him, help us against the anti-Semites, and I will start a great movement for the free and honorable conversion of Jews to Christianity. Free and honorable, Listen to this, it's amazing. By virtue of the fact that the leaders of my movement, myself in particular, would remain Jews. He couldn't bring himself to convert. And he figures out a whole svara why that makes sense. So I'm personally not going to convert, but the others will. And as such, would propagate conversion to the faith of the majority. The conversion, and if you read the Jewish state, by the way, he was a dreamer, Herzl. Right? There's no question that he deserves credit for being the founder of the Jewish state, but it's not because any of his ideas were in the slightest bit realistic. Read that book, and it's the man was, as we used to say, out to lunch. He lived in a dream world, and precisely because of that, I guess he was able to make it happen. But he always had these grandiose visions. So later on, he had these grandiose visions. Read his book, Alt Neuland, and you see the way he envisions. Some of that has come true, by the way. But here he's envisioning this with the same drama. The conversion will take place in broad daylight, Sunday at noon in St. Stephen's Cathedral, with festive processions amidst the pealing of bells, not in shame, as individuals have converted up to now, but with proud gestures. And because the Jewish leaders would remain Jews, escorting the people to the threshold of the church, but themselves staying outside, the whole performance... So he's explaining how this is actually going to make it better. The whole performance will be elevated by a touch of great candor. We, the steadfast men, would have constituted the last generation. We would still have adhered to the faith of our fathers, but we would have made Christians of our young sons before they reach the age of independent decision, after which conversion looks like an act of cowardice or careerism. As is my custom, I have thought out the entire plan down to all of its minute details. I could see myself dealing with the Archbishop of Vienna. In imagination, I stood before the Pope. Both of them were very sorry that I wished to do no more than remain part of the last generation of Jews, and sent this slogan of mingling of the races flying across the world. What happened to this plan? So he tells you that he wanted to publish it in the newspaper for which he worked, the New Freie Press in Germany. And he sent a draft of it to the editor, whose name was Moritz Benedict himself, an assimilated Jew married to a Christian. And the response he got from the editor was, "For 100 generations, your line has preserved itself within the fold of Judaism. Now you are proposing to set yourself up as the terminal point in this process. This you cannot do." This is the assimilated Jew married to a Christian who says, "This you cannot do and have no right to do. And besides, the Pope would never receive you. It won't work anyway." So Herzl scrapped that plan, and 2 years later, he wrote, or 3 years later, he became a Zionist. So this was his last desperate attempt. You know, they're not accepting us. Maybe if we become Christians, they'll accept.
They never did before. Why would
of course
they
not.
Start now?
Of course not. And that's exactly what Moritz Benedict told him. Come down to earth. So this is the last desperate gasp of Herzl's assimilationism. But you see in it that in the depths of his soul, he just wanted to fit in. Fascinating question that people debate, whether he ever changed that idea. There are those who say that he never really got out of assimilationism, and the state of Israel in his mind was just going to be the national assimilation of the Jewish people into the community of nations. I think that's an oversimplification, but this is not about Herzl, so we won't go further on that. I think Herzl is a little deeper than that. And a little bit more complex. But I often found, so when I was thinking about this, I found myself wondering what Herzl desperately wanted to find and couldn't in late 19th century Europe exists in early 21st century America. And if Herzl could have seen that, would he still have become a Zionist?
Probably not.
Maybe not. And, so, put that way, and this is why I think Herzl is relevant to this conversation, the majority, by far, of today's American Jews are doing exactly what Herzl's default position was, except it wasn't possible back then, and they're doing it now. So that they're not going to convert to Christianity. They don't need to. I'm just Jewish. But what I really am is American. And I'm really no different than any of the other Americans. This is who I am. This is my identity. This is my future. This is my destiny. Yeah, I'm Jewish. And my friend's Italian. It also helps that America, and maybe this is the difference between America and Europe, America doesn't really have an ethnic heritage. America's a e pluribus unum, right? America's a society of immigrants, a great melting pot, they used to call it. And today it's not even a melting pot. Today it's a multicultural... Right? Toss salad, they say, right? Exactly. Okay, so Everyone has a little bit of color and a little bit of, you know, interesting facts about them, right? So my interesting fact is that I'm Jewish, but what I am is American. Okay, so that's, I'm not evaluating still. I'm just depicting what I see.
I think the 60%...
Oh, I'm sorry. Just give me 1 second. I got distracted. I never got back to what I was saying. And then I'll take your comment. So on the birthright, I'm sorry. So we have this Jewish identity game, right? And you have these cards with these things, and then you break the kids up into groups, and they have to like rank them in terms of what's the most important, less important, and then they discuss it, and they present it. So we give them like 20 different Jewish values, and they have to get it down to the top 5 or something. You could do it different ways. That's usually the way we do it. On the last birthright trip I ran, I think there were 4 groups. Every single one of the 4 groups put number 1 Jewish value being a moral and ethical person, which is undoubtedly a Jewish value, but also not a particularly Jewish value. Not one. There were 4 groups who each had to pick 5 values, I think. Not one of them included any of the following in their list of top 5. Marrying a Jew, studying Jewish texts, raising Jewish children. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Wow.
After birthright, a lot of them will change.
Okay.
We hope.
I've seen it. I'll get to that in a minute, too. Okay? But this is the...
Incoming.
Right. We'll get to what birthright is in a minute. But right, that's the...
So it's a representative of American youth.
Yeah. And these are the ones who come on birthright.
Right, yeah.
These are the ones who come on birthright who were at least Jewish enough that somebody found them, and that at least to get a free trip were willing to come. And for many of them, it's more than that. And by the way, not every kid who comes on birthright meets this profile. There are those with much stronger Jewish identities. But this is a large percentage. Okay. So that's one. That's one. I'm sorry, what did you want to say?
No, I find that 60% ethical is very interesting.
Meaning?
Even if they don't know what the texts are, they feel like they should be ethical. And they're proud of that. That's very interesting.
Yes.
That's the most important thing in Judaism, don't you? It's the only thing that goes through all the treaties.
I'm not denying that. And especially in the 3 weeks, and another week and a half, we'll read Yeshayahu, who says exactly that. It says the Mikdash was destroyed not because of anything else. Yeshayahu talks about justice and justice and justice. There's no question about that.
The
at the same time,
a Catholic church group, they would put that value as
for sure.
And a Muslim group would
for sure. And on one hand, we could say as Jews, we're the ones who brought that value to the world. That's also true.
But Orthodox Jews have to be the number one.
Perhaps not. And then maybe that's a problem also.
Yeah.
All true. I agree with everything you're saying, but for the purpose of this conversation, what it says to me is that they're latching on to something that you don't have to be particularly Jewish in their worldview, at least.
And it's more than that, they're not latching on to anything.
Correct.
Specifically.
Correct. Correct. I agree with you, 100%. It would certainly be, I don't know if it would be my number one or my number two, that's a separate issue, but it would certainly be, if not number one, number two. And not for now. Why?
Did you do the same thing when they left? Did you answer them those same questions?
This actually was done shortly before they left, near the end of the trip. But that's not. You really would have to do it a few years later, whatever. Okay, that's one response. At the other extreme, both in terms of what it represents, and at the other extreme also numerically, you have another American Jewish response, which is Aliyah. It's the other extreme conceptually, because instead of completely blending into American society, it's the option of saying, thank you very much, I'm going to leave. That's, of course, the option that I chose. And I'll get back to that in a few minutes also, but I, for one, you know, did not make Aliyah from the United States. I made Aliyah to Israel, by which I mean... I have very positive feelings of the United States. I love the United States. And not only am I culturally American, I genuinely admire the United States. I really do think it's the greatest country in human history. I really mean that. I'm very grateful for what the United States did for my family, literally saving all of our families probably at the time that it did, or many of them at least, most of them. And I very much respect and admire the United States, but... my response to this opportunity was to say, if I have the opportunity to go home, I'm going to go home. So it's the opposite. Saying to the offer of assimilation, thank you, but no thank you. And leaving to the other incredible option that exists nowadays, joining Medinat Yisrael. So it's the opposite extreme conceptually. It's also the opposite extreme numerically. Whereas the vast majority of American Jews are assimilating, the number making Aliyah is below minuscule. Okay, there are approximately between 3,000 and 4,000 Jews who make Aliyah every year from the United States. That might sound like a lot until you compare it to the number 5.7 million. Do the math. I'll spare you the... It's about 1/20 of 1%. That means that although every American Jew... And by the way, that 5.7 million is not... The second number that Sergio, however you pronounce his name, uses is what he calls is the law of return population. In other words, the people that have the right by Israel's law of return to come, and that's a much larger number.
Right.
But even if we look at those 5.7 million, every single one of them is offered citizenship by the State of Israel. And every single year, 99.95% say no thank you, or at least not yet. That's just the numbers, okay? But still, this is another potential American Jewish response. What about everybody else? What about those who are staying in America and are not assimilating, or at least trying not to, who are not just Jewish, but whose Jewishness is important to them, and who are trying to build Jewish communities in the United States? So here we have to look at several different types of communities. I'll do this quickly because I don't want to get to the analysis. Among the non-Orthodox, and there still are vibrant and committed Jewish communities that are not Orthodox, even if they're shrinking, as they are, but they still exist. If you look at the organized Jewish communities outside the Orthodox community in the United States, how are they building Jewish identity and, trying to infuse life and meaning into their Jewish communities? So by far, the flagship program to do so is Birthright, which is an American program, even though Birthright is open to, I think there are 67 countries that send the people on Birthright, the vast majority, because the vast majority of the Jews in the world are in the United States, so the vast majority of Birthright groups are from the United States. And, of course, Birthright is an American invention. American Jewish community invented it.
Canada also,
and 67 other countries.
It's all over the world, not just
yes,
America.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah, there are Birthright groups in 30 different languages. German, Spanish, for sure. And yeah. I am a Birthright group from Poland, everywhere. And Birthright does make a difference. And I could tell stories. Personally and, anecdotally, and also there's much research that, the Birthright organization puts a lot of money into professional research to gauge the results, and there's no question that Birthright is making a major impact. But let's stop and think about what this means. When the American Jewish community wants to figure out ways, and by the way, Birthright has three stated goals. If you ask the Birthright organization, what is Birthright for? What are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish? Three things. Connection between the diaspora and Israel. Building Jewish identity, not necessarily in this order. Building Jewish identity and strengthening Jewish communities around the world. And when they want to strengthen their Jewish community, the way they do it, the way they want to build a Jewish community in America is by sending kids to Israel. Think about that. And when it does work, the Birthright success stories, the kids on Birthright who get very, very involved are almost definitely going to be coming back to Israel again and again and again, and in many cases will wind up making Aliyah. Not only Orthodox, by far not only.
What percentage?
I don't know. That number I don't have. Yes.
Could you repeat the third? You said connection.
Strengthening.
I asked for...
Jewish identity, strengthening Jewish communities, and connection between the diaspora Jews and Israel.
Thank you.
So that says something very, very powerful, right? The way that they find most effective, maybe the only way, to keep a vibrant Jewish community. See, because what kept Jewish communities alive throughout history? Let's be honest. Anti-Semitism. You were Jewish because you had to be. Today in America, you don't have to be. And that's why so many Jews in America are saying, well, if I don't have to be, then why should I be? Or at least, why should I be in any meaningful way? And the way to fight that, it seems, is through Israel. But not only that. You are hearing a lot nowadays about how there's this growing rift, it's like this all over the press all the time, this growing rift between American Jews and Israel, and how there's this alienation, particularly because of the policies of the Israeli government, whether it's the so-called occupation or whether it's the lack of prayer area at the Kotel or whatever the story is. First of all, and here I have only anecdotal evidence, but I think that although that undoubtedly exists, I think it's exaggerated. I don't think those, I think that the vast majority of American Jews maybe are ambivalent, and or if you ask them their opinion on, will advocate for a two-state solution or something like that. But those who feel alienated from Israel, I think my sense is the numbers are much lower than what you're seeing in the press. But here's a...
Okay.
So maybe here, living in Israel and seeing the Jews that I see in Israel, maybe I'm getting a distorted
again,
picture.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Jews that are coming up,
I talk to the kids, again, I've seen certain kids, I talk to the kids about their experience on campus.
You know, I would do this almost dollars and cents-wise, I'm sorry, but I was director of KKL in the United States, and I was director of United Jewish Appeal National Campaign. Just by dollars and cents, if you go back generations, even to 8 years ago, there is not a person, a Jew, that never gave a penny into a JNF box. Okay? You can't, JNF's strong in America, but for different reasons. Very hard to find those kids willing to do it now because they think that Israel is the cause of their problems.
Well, the question is whether that second half of the sentence is true. In other words, whether the drop in donations is for that reason or just because they don't care enough to give money. The fact that I'm not willing to give money doesn't necessarily mean that I'm opposed.
They don't care.
Okay, so maybe I'm wrong about that, but here's I just want to say one thing.
Even our kids coming out of Zionistic schools,
right. You can be Jewish.
Find Israel, unless they're very pro, find Israel problematic.
So here's what I'm driving at. We can debate to what extent that exists. It definitely exists. And my sense is that the picture again in the media is exaggerated. Maybe I'm wrong, but either way. There was over the last few weeks, there's been a lot of press coverage of this group called If Not Now, right? That's trying to get attention. So it's radical. I guess they would claim they're not anti-Israel, but, one of those, I don't know if they support BDS, but we'll get to BDS in a second. So, they've been making a lot of, they've been doing these publicity stunts. They've been showing up at JFK Airport and setting up these, handing out flyers to kids going on Birthright, coming over to kids who are online, checking in for their Birthright flight, handing out flyers, here's questions you should be asking about the occupation. And then they staged two weeks ago, they had a few kids who were members of their organization who sort of, I guess you could say, infiltrated a Birthright. I mean, they applied for Birthright, and they went on a Birthright trip, but this apparently was planned in advance. On the last day of the trip, they demonstratively, one of the girls took a microphone on the bus, and they had someone, videoing it. And she announced that they're leaving the trip because they weren't given a fair representation, and you've been lied to. And we're going to Hebron to see the occupation. They got off the bus, and there were people there from one of the from Breaking the Silence, ready to take them to Hebron. And the whole thing was videoed as
As a high school teacher for over 30 years, that age was on this trip, 18 whatever. That's so impressionable. And for that
for sure.
to happen on the last day with a bus with a microphone?
That's why they did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, most of the kids on the Birthright trips, reacted negatively against these people. They're not that stupid. But that's not the point I'm driving at. Here's the point I'm making. Whether this is a fringe group or whether it's, which is what it looks like to me, or whether it does represent something, wider. It also says something. In other words, one of the girls, they interviewed her, and I agree with her. She's just parroting whatever she's been told. She says, I came on this trip to learn about my Jewish heritage and my Jewish community, and I love my Jewish community so much that I have to fight for the values of my community. When I see oppression, I have to fight against it. What am I driving at? Even those Jews who are defining their Jewish identity this way, they still need Israel. They need Israel to have something to oppose. Right? But their Jewish identity revolves around Israel, one way or the other. Even in the negative.
For Syrian refugees or any other cause
right.
in the world.
For sure. For sure. Okay, I'm watching the clock, so let me just speed up here a little bit. Among the Orthodox, let's get closer to home here. I think this is certainly in the modern Orthodox community, there's no question, the modern Orthodox community, which is Baruch Hashem, very vibrant and growing numerically, is very, very much focused on Israel through Zionist education, through Yom HaTzmaut, through things like that, and for the fact that Baruch Hashem, they send their kids to Israel. Usually a typical American kid comes at least on a summer tour in high school usually, and certainly for a year after Israel, after high school. That's, you know, very, very important movement that I've been involved with the last 20 years, teaching American kids on the, you know, gap year programs here in Israel. And those programs have had a major impact on Aliyah. Among Orthodox people making Aliyah, almost all of them came to Israel, and, you know, myself included, you know, to learn for a year. But they've also revolutionized Jewish life in America, right? So the Orthodox community in America as well is to a very large extent building its identity around Israel. I was going to go into an analysis of the so-called yeshivish community, the Haredi community. It's more complex there, but I, for lack of time, I'm not going to get into that because I want to get to the end. But I believe it's true for them too, even though it's a little harder to see. Their Jewish identity is very, very much revolving around Israel. So what all this says to me, and I'm sure many American Jews will be offended by this statement, and I hope no one here is, but I'm going to say it like I see it. The American Jewish community today, across the board, is a satellite of Israel, and is largely dependent on Israel to keep itself going. And when I see that in the larger perspective of history, going back to what I said earlier, that means that this final galut in the generation of Kibbutz Galuyot, so that all starts to make sense. So now the question is, what does this all mean? Okay, if I've made the case that what's going on today is completely unprecedented, and that if you're in the here looking at Jewish communities from the Middle Ages and from more recent times in Spain and in North Africa and in Europe and all these different places, that what's going on in America today is completely in a separate category. And it has to do, it's not by accident, that it just happens to be at the same time that we have Medina Israel. So what does this all mean? So in the few minutes we have left, if you can turn over to the... Let me just read with you a few biblical passages that I think are relevant. At first glance, at least, these passages seem to imply that what's happening today can't happen. Vayikra, Ve'etchem ezzareh bagoyim, I shall scatter you among the nations. Varikot, this is from the Tochacha. Varikot yachreichem chere, v'aitar tzechem shmama, v'arichem yu chorba. There's a prediction that you're going to be sent into exile, your land will be destroyed, and you'll be scattered. Ezzareh bagoyim. We'll skip a little bit there. And the last psukim. Va'avadetem bagoyim, va'achale etchem eretz oyveichem. The land of your enemies shall swallow you up. But what does that mean exactly? Take a look at Dvarim, a parallel passage there, second source. Dehefitzcha Hashem b'chol ha'amim. God will scatter you among the nations, mikzei ha'aretz v'kzei ha'aretz, from one end of the world to the other. Vavadat Hashem Elohim achirim asher lo yadata tav avotecha eitz v'aven. You will assimilate, you'll worship foreign gods. Uvagoyim ahem lo targiyah, but you shall not find rest there. V'lo yiyem anoach l'chaf raglecha, you will not be able to rest. Benatan Hashem l'chasham, and there God will give you lev ragaz v'chilyon enayim v'davon nefesh. You'll be very, very disturbed there. V'yu chayecha tlim l'cha mineged, u'fachar et alayla v'yomam v'lo tamim b'chayecha. You'll be terrified night and day, b'boker tomar mi'itin erev, erev tomar mi'itin boker. Mi'pachad v'avcha. You'll be terrified and you won't know where to go first. This seems very, very accurate description of Theodor Herzl. It doesn't sound like what I'm seeing in America today. Look at Yechezkel, Perichov. Yechezkel sitting in Babylonia, around the time of the Churban of the first Beit HaMikdash, with Jews that had been exiled earlier. He tells them, "Ve'ha'ole al ruchachem hayo lo tiyeh. That which you're thinking will not happen. Asher atem omrim, nihyeh kagoyim, kemishpechot ha'ratzot, v'sharet eitz ve'evim." Yechezkel tells him, what you were thinking, let's just assimilate. It's not going to happen. Hayo lo tihiyeh. Chayani nuhum Hashem. Im lo biyad chazakah v'zroa netuyah v'chema shfucha im lo chalechem. I swear, says God, I'm going to rule over you with a strong arm and a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Echoes of Yitzhak Mitzrayim only backwards of v'chema shfucha and with outpoured fury. I'm going to take you out from among the nations, v'kibatzti etchem min ha'aratzot, asher nefatzotem shbam, I will take you out from all the exiles where I had sent you, b'yad chazaka v'zronet tuyav l'chema shpucha, so I'm going to take you out of the exile with a strong hand, outstretched arm, and with outpoured fury. V'heveti etchem el midbar ha'amim. Just like when I took you out of Egypt, I brought you out to a desert, I'm going to bring you out to a desert. Midbar ha'amim, the desert of the nations. V'nishpatati etchem sham, panim el panim. And there I will judge you. Kasher nishpatati et avotechem b'midbar eretz Mitzrayim. Kene shafet etchem ne'um Hashem Elokim. Just like I judged your ancestors in the desert, and a whole generation of them never made it, I will judge you in this desert. V'avarti etchem tachat hashevet v'aviti etchem b'masoret habrit. I shall bring you into the affliction of the covenant. Uvaroti mikem, and I shall select from you hamordim v'poshim bi me'eretz megurehem otziotam. Those who rebel against me, I will take them out from the land in which they dwell. Be'elav mat Yisrael lo yavo, but they shall not come into the land of Israel. V'idatem ki ani yad Hashem, and you shall know that I am God. Wow. So there's this, the commentaries discuss what exactly is the meaning of this image of the desert of the nations, Midbar Ha'amim. But it seems that there's this in-between stage. At the time of the exile, when the exile comes to an end, rather, God, according to this prophecy, takes us out of the exile, but doesn't bring us directly to the land of Israel, and he brings us to this place called Midbar Ha'amim. And there he selects those who will survive and those who will not. Those who will make it and those who will not. They've already been taken out from their homes. So again, when I read these psukim, I see what happened a few decades after Herzl passed away in 1914 in those places where they tried to assimilate. I don't see room in these prophecies for what's going on there. What do I do with this? So there are at least two ways you can read this. And what some undoubtedly will and do and say to me when I say things like this is apparently, people tell me, that what this means is that my analysis of what's going on in America today, that it's completely unique and everything I just said is wrong. And that the whole thing is an illusion. And that God forbid, I don't want to say the words, but people read into these prophecies a prediction of a violent and horrific end for American Jewry as well. And say, here it is. And talk, God forbid, about a second Holocaust and all types of things like that. I don't know the future. I certainly can't discount that possibility. At the same time, I also don't want to, and don't think we need to assume such a thing. Question is, so that's undoubtedly one way to read this, but is there another way? And in the 2 minutes I've left, I'd like to suggest that perhaps there is. I'd like to suggest a reading, particularly the Pesukim in Yechezkel, but it also goes back to Vayikra, Va'achala etchem eretz odechem, the land of your enemies shall consume you. I'd like to suggest a different way to read those Pesukim, which is admittedly a little bit difficult, but I think it can work. And that perhaps the Midbar Ha'amim that's being discussed here, the selection, if you will, can take a much more gentle form. In other words, if American Jewry is assimilating, one way to read these psukim is Yechezkel's warning, you think you're going to assimilate, it's not going to work, and the fury's going to come down. But another way to read it is that the destruction is the assimilation. And the Midbar Ha'amim, so go back to what we talked about how America today doesn't exactly look like exile. It's almost as if exile is over, but there's this in-between state. V'hotzeiti etchem el midbar ha'amim, v'ha'avarti etchem tachat hashevet, I will count you there, umvoroti mikem, and I shall select from among you those who will not come and those who will. That's a much more, well, I don't know if it's more pleasant. It's certainly more, certainly less horrific, but in...
Less horrific.
But it's also not positive. But if that's the case, then the selection process, if you will, that's even a bad word to use on this.
Yeah.
But that's what can I tell you? Varoti
choosing.
Mikem.
Choosing.
Varoti, okay. But brera means actually. So that makes valiant efforts such as Birthright and things like it, you know, perhaps the gain spiritual significance in the sense that ultimately it becomes the choice of those American Jews themselves to what extent they blend away and to what extent they don't. And this final step in the Galut becomes ultimately dependent on, you know, the outcome becomes dependent on to what extent it puts the selection not in God's hands as much as in the people's hands themselves. And I don't have time, but if you look at the Pesukim in Hosea, which is a parallel Nevuah, there the Midbar, Rashi on the Pasuk in Yechezkel makes the connection to Hosea, and there the Midbar is a more positive image. And perhaps, you know, perhaps if we read America as that Midbar Ha'amim, that desert among the nations, so it has the potential for curse and it has the potential for blessing, and a lot of it has to do with the Jews themselves. Let me just close with one little vignette. A few months ago, for the first and perhaps only time in my life, I went to Poland. I've always not been a big fan of these trips to Poland, and I still am not so much, but I finally felt I had to go. So I went with some students of mine from Nishmat and some girls from Migdalos. And at the age of 51, it was a very important experience for me. And when you go through Poland, in addition to, of course, seeing the terrible destruction that happened, you see the remnants of the vibrant Jewish life that was there. And again and again and again, you go into these beautiful shuls that are hundreds of years old, and they're empty. They're museums. There's nobody there to pray in them. And then I found myself, on the one hand, this is so sad. On the other hand, what do I want? Like, do I want to send Jews back to Poland now to dominate? Like, what? So I was thinking about this, and I got up on Shabbat, and when I spoke to the girls, I said something that got a lot of them very upset, which admittedly is part of what I was trying to do. But I'll say it now, and with this I'll close. I told them that as shocking as this is going to sound, I told them, I want you to think about your shul in America and realize that the day will come when the shul that you come from, Teaneck and the Five Towns, or wherever you're from, Chicago, Toronto, wherever you're from, is going to look exactly like those shuls in Tikochin and in Lansut and in Zamosh and in all these other places. Maybe it'll be a museum. There won't be anyone there to daven there anymore. That has to happen. And it's supposed to happen, as sad as that might seem. The next sentence I said also, but it was too hard for them to hear. Maybe it was a mistake to say it in Poland, but I'll say it here. I hope and pray it doesn't have to end the same way. And I hope it won't. But it does have to end. And perhaps it's up to the American Jewish community to decide how it's going to end. And whether this very unusual galut becomes a glorious end to the galut. And with this I'll close. If America today is the only place in the world and perhaps the only place in history where Jews really had the option to assimilate, it's also the only place from which one has the privilege of being able to make Aliyah 100% by choice, not because you can't stay where you are. And because of that, maybe right now there's 99.95% of the Jews every year say no. But that makes the option of saying yes that much, much, much more powerful. And I guess our job is to try to push the American Jewish community in that direction. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi Haber. Sounds very thought-provoking from that.